This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So to remind us of the acronym that we started this course off with today, of the common social vulnerabilities, today we're going to be speaking about two or three of them, the third on the list here being literacy and language, and then down a little over halfway, the vulnerability of immigrant. Obviously, as the story of Ed Lee makes very clear, immigration and immigrants is both a vulnerability and an asset. And so I think it's good to remind ourselves that that our patients do come with vulnerabilities, but also a lot of resilience. And part of what we hope to have conveyed over the course of this these lectures is the importance of identifying those assets and points of resilience. So health literacy is a term that has been popularized over, I'd say, the last 15 years and has been defined, and this is the definition that actually was used in the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as the degree to which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process, and understand basic health information and services needed to make, and I added this word here, to make informed health decisions. People tend to think of health literacy in a fairly narrow way, that is, that it's a fixed characteristic as opposed to something that can change over time, that people can learn and have their health literacy increase over time, or that it's something that is primarily limited to difficulties reading, whereas we know that the domain of literacy is a much more complex and multifaceted domain, dimension, and it includes between three and six domains, depending on how you want, if you're a lumper or a splitter. We know that people with limited literacy skills also are challenged in their oral literacy skills, meaning the complexity of their speech, the speed of their speech, the listening skills, and the ability to retain information, particularly complex multi-step information. So it's not just the written word, but of course one does have a higher likelihood of having difficulties reading health materials and writing health content. For example, if you're writing an email to your physician, that might be more challenging. And folks with limited literacy skills also are much more likely to have difficulty with numeracy or quantitative literacy skills. That involves things like making calculations, insulin doses, as we talked about in the first lecture, understanding relative risks or risk reduction. If you take this medicine to lower your cholesterol, you could reduce your risk of stroke by 20%. Do people really understand that? Well, folks with limited health literacy are much less likely than those with adequate health literacy to understand those types of messages. Increasingly, we're understanding that limited health literacy extends to digital communication, and as healthcare becomes more digitized, particularly around electronic patient portals, I don't know how many of you actually are connected to or use a patient portal. You want to raise your hand if you... Great, you are. Okay, so a little over half of you. We know that patients with limited health literacy are much less likely to have signed on to the patient portal, and among those who've signed on to actively use it, whether it's to make appointments, refill their medications, or email their clinicians. But when they do, they appear to have greater difficulty in understanding what they're being sent and in communicating with their physicians or understanding what their physicians are trying to communicate to them. Now, rather than thinking about limited health literacy as this fixed characteristic, I think it's best to consider health literacy as a balance or an imbalance between the capacity and preparedness of the patient and her family or caregivers and the demands that we as a healthcare system or society at large place on our patients. And it's the size of that gap, the size of that imbalance, which can determine the degree to which health literacy is contributing to people's difficulties in managing their illnesses. The best metaphor I can think of for this is remembering, this dates me a little bit, but when we first got our first VCR, you know, those VHS tapes, and you had to connect it to your TV, and you had to do all these, and I just could never do it, and I'd read the manual, and it was impossible. And you compare that to when you buy a new iPhone now, they've kind of figured out how people with low computer literacy can use these digital tools by creating interfaces that significantly lower the demands on the consumer, in this case, to use and optimize the use of a resource, which is technology. In the same way, healthcare services are a resource, and the extent to which we as healthcare providers and healthcare systems make it difficult or easier for our patients is a strong determinant of the health literacy calculus. So what do we know about the health literacy levels of residents of the United States? We know a fairly detailed amount, and I'm just going to give you a quick summary of what we know. This is based on a very large household survey that was done about 15 years ago during actually the Bush era, although I understand that the appropriation was done during the Clinton era. But nonetheless, they sent in employees of the U.S. Department of Education into the households of nearly 20,000 U.S. adults and asked these families to identify the self-reported best reader in the family, and then presented that best reader with a litany of stimuli, literacy stimuli, in a number of domains, everything from map reading to recipes to health-related materials, financial literacy, all kinds of things. And I will report to you here on what we learned about the literacy skills as they relate to the health stimuli that people were exposed to. And the way, well, given that this was the Bush era, the way they categorized people was in the 9/11 color-coded scheme of green, blue, yellow, and red, or orange and red, right? Remember those days and after 9/11 when we were constantly on orange and sometimes we were on red? And so to give you a sense of what these categories mean, people who scored in the green proficient realm of health literacy, to give you an example of what these folks could do, it represents an ability to calculate, for example, an employee's share of health insurance costs using a table. So I don't know if you have had the recent experience of having to select a health plan or a health insurer. One of the things you might want to look at is, okay, if I have to take, let's say my daughter hurts her ankle and I have to take her into the emergency room to get her ankle x-rayed, how much is that going to cost me? As opposed to if I wait till tomorrow, because I'm a little cheaper, and I bring her into urgent care, how much is that going to cost me? And so to do that calculation, I need to look at a table that that describes the costs associated with a particular health service use. It's kind of complicated stuff. It requires the ability to understand a graph and to make some inferences about what's being presented. So people in the proficient range, 50% of the time, got those stimuli right. In the intermediate category, 50% of the people who responded could correctly determine what time to take a prescribed medication based on a prototypical medication label. These are, as you know, labels that are very small. They have a lot of writing on them. They give instructions that to doctors seem very clear, take one pill three times a day, but to a patient may mean take three pills once a day, or take one pill now and one pill in an hour and one pill tonight. I mean, there are a lot of potential variation in how people understand and interpret those instructions. That's intermediate. The basic category, the example of the stimulus that was given here was a fifth grade level cancer screening brochure, in this case related to prostate cancer screening. And people were asked to read this brochure and then afterwards give two reasons why a person with no symptoms should get tested for cancer based on what was presented in the pamphlet. And half of the people in the basic category got that right. And finally, the below basic category was the ability to simply circle the date on a sample doctor's appointment slip. And so half of the people in the below basic category were able to do that. So you can see this hierarchy of complexity of terms of literacy demands. This is how the United States sample, representative sample, panned out in terms of their health literacy proficiency, with 12% of the population being proficient, deemed to be proficient, about half of the population being in the intermediate health literacy category. The arrows didn't show up here. I can tell you that the average Medicare patient hovers just above the cusp between basic and intermediate, so sort of at 7 o'clock, if you will, on this circle. 22% of the population was in the basic category, and just by way of point of reference, Medicaid patients on average, Hispanic patients on average, and African American patients. These aren't patients. These are residents. These are healthy people. On average, we're in the basic category at about 4 o'clock, so at the lower end of the basic category. And 14% of the U.S. residents were in the below basic category, could half the time correctly circle an appointment list. Now, we have known for a very long time, based on work in the so-called developing world, that literacy is a strong predictor of health outcomes, particularly maternal literacy is a strong predictor of childhood health outcomes. And so a lot of UN policy and other global policy has been focused on improving maternal literacy as an important vehicle to improve economic and health outcomes in the world. What had not been known until fairly recently was whether or not these different levels of literacy, which are very different from what was measured in the global context. In the global context, it was, can you sign your name, yes or no? If you could sign your name, you were considered literate. Here, these folks can sign their name. This is about different levels in the spectrum of literacy in the United States. What had not been known was whether or not these different levels of literacy skills matter in terms of health, incident of health conditions and control of health outcomes. And this has been most well studied in the case of diabetes. And I just want to kind of lay out how this has played out. We know from work that was done in Atlanta in the late 1990s that even after patients with diabetes have been exposed to diabetes education classes, those in the lowest health literacy category were least likely to have gained the requisite skills or the at least learned the basic learning objectives of the curriculum when compared to those with higher literacy skills. Now, this is primarily oral instruction that is being assessed, and in this case, we're talking about one of the survival skills of diabetes care, which is the identification and prevention of hypoglycemia over treatment of high blood sugar. And so in this case, people who'd been exposed to diabetes education classes in general did not universally take away what we call the need to know, symptoms of low blood glucose like shakiness, sweating, faintness, etc., or the need to do. What do you do if you feel those things? You know, it's eat a Snickers bar or have a glass of orange juice. And this is true for high and low literacy patients, but was more true for those with lower health literacy. We extended this study in the context of our primary care clinics at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, specifically looking at the internal medicine and family medicine clinics in a little over 400 patients. These are among English and Spanish speakers, and we assessed health literacy skills both in English and in Spanish. And we found that while it's true that people have lower knowledge of some of the skills, it also appeared that folks with the lower health literacy levels were less likely to have optimal blood sugar control, essentially half as likely as those in the higher literacy categories to have well-controlled blood sugars. And this is a blood sugar over a significant amount of time, and twice as likely to have very poorly controlled blood sugar. Now, this is what we call a cross-sectional study. It's one slice in time, and so the question that we asked was, well, okay, maybe today this is true, but is this associated with more higher rates of the complications of diabetes that we see, like blindness or retinal disease or kidney disease, et cetera. And we found, if you look at the middle column, which is the odds ratio, the odds that people with low literacy were more likely to have eye disease, kidney disease, an amputation, a prior stroke, or heart disease, On average, it was, again, about a doubling of the risk for those with low health literacy compared to those with high health literacy. And this is even after statistically adjusting for many, many things related to social status, ethnicity, medication regimen, et cetera. We still found what's called an independent effect of one's literacy status on one's complication rates from diabetes. And this is important because, unlike some of the other vulnerabilities that we've been talking about, let's take homelessness, for example, you know, where I'm in the office visit and I can develop a treatment plan that perhaps is tailored to the needs of someone with homelessness, but it's very hard for me to get them a home, right? In the case of limited literacy skills, this kind of disparity feels kind of closer to me as a clinician because we hypothesize there's something that's going on in the communication process, or not going on in the communication process, that is leaving the patient unprepared to manage their health condition. And therefore, in some way, it feels like I can more directly, or potentially could more directly, have a positive influence on reducing disparities if we were to learn more about how to communicate in the context of limited health literacy. And I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. Now, I will share with you that I presented these data on this campus about 10 or 12 years ago, and we had a different chair of medicine at that time, who I won't say had really seen the light in terms of health disparities. And his comment to me as the first question in the grand rounds I gave was, well, this is all well and good, and I understand that this is a problem at San Francisco General Hospital, but is it true with real people, quote unquote? And I think what he meant was with people who are insured, citizens, et cetera, et cetera. So I swallowed my tongue, but I had one slide in my back pocket, which was we had done this study at Kaiser Permanente, which apparently cares for a lot of real people, and found that about 30% of their diabetes patients had limited health literacy as well. It wasn't just a problem in the public hospital. And that when we looked at an outcome, in this case, hypoglycemia, a severe adverse effect, side effect in a way of one's medication, that in theory should be rare, we found, A, that it was quite common with about on average 10% of people having experienced one or more serious hypoglycemic low blood sugar episodes per year, but that those with limited health literacy in turquoise here were significantly more likely to have experienced this adverse event, something that is costly, something that is associated with can be associated with hospitalization and death in certain instances, but certainly is not a high-quality outcome for any institution, let alone Kaiser. So in short, this is this health literacy problem is certainly concentrated in safety net healthcare settings, but we see it in all healthcare settings, and it contributes to preventable suffering, excess costs, and even death. Now, the question, of course, we are always asking, not like, is there another study to show that poverty sucks and look, the p-value is less than 0.01, which is a statistic that we use, but what if anything, can we do about it? And what is behind this? And so here's a little cartoon to suggest what might be behind at least part of this. This is, my doctor said only one glass of alcohol a day. I can live with that, right? So we've known for quite a long time that patients take away less than half of what we have communicated to them in our visit. That's on a good day. And that really is only about recall. Can patients recall half of what we said? It doesn't even talk about whether or not people have understood it and integrated it into their neural pathways to be able to use that information. So one of the hypotheses was that perhaps this really is a communication problem. And one of the greatest quotes on this issue is the playwright George Bernard Shaw. This is just a beautiful quote, and I remind myself of it every day whenever I have a miscommunication with a colleague or a patient or my wife, is the problem with communication is the assumption that it has occurred. Right? We've all had that experience. Like we had this conversation. Why did this screw up happen? And it only happened because you think you had the conversation, but the person you were talking to either wasn't listening or was hearing something different from what you intended, or who knows, they were on to other things. So airplane pilots know this. Air traffic control knows this. They always repeat back what the instructions were to make sure they're landing in Cleveland and not Canton, Ohio. But we in healthcare don't seem to use those universal precautions of ensuring that our communication has been heard. So in the San Francisco General, again, we asked these same patients with diabetes to report on the communication that they have with their doctors. And I just want to share with you, how many of you, if you just raise your hand, have ever filled out a patient satisfaction rating on your doctor? Okay, most of you. I can tell you that on average, the satisfaction scores at the highest, like the great, this is the greatest doctor kind of score, are about 85 to 90%. People generally like their doctors. If they didn't, they'd probably switch. And it's a little bit ego dystonic to keep going to the same doctor that you don't like. And so in general, we doctors score very well. And some of us are lucky enough to get bonuses if we work in certain places where our patient satisfaction scores generate income for us. Our San Francisco General is not, doesn't happen to be one of those places. But so my point is that on average, about 10 to 15% of our patients score us in the below excellent category. And when you start seeing rates of below excellent of 25, 30, 35%, that's a real signal. It's not just noise. And what we found was that patients with inadequate health literacy skills were more likely to report that their doctor often or always used words that they didn't understand, that their doctor often or always gave them test results without explanations, that they often or always were confused about their own medical care, or that their doctor never, rarely, or only sometimes understood the kinds of problems that they, the patient, would have in carrying forward the treatment plan. It's like an interactive communication. So really almost a tripling, a doubling or tripling of sort of negative communication experiences. So this was intriguing to me, and it raised the question, particularly around this issue of doctors using words that they didn't understand. I looked in the literature, and you know, I've basically made a career of doing really stupid studies and getting them published because people just haven't asked these stupid basic questions before. So I was interested in, do doctors use jargon in their visits? And there had been no study that had looked at that. There was only one study, and it was something like we went to the Stonestown Mall down at, you know, on 19th Avenue, and we opened up Stedman's Medical Dictionary, and we asked people what the word metastasis means. And lo and behold, only 1% of the mall goers knew the word metastasis, and the sky is falling. The world is, you know, people have low health literacy. Well, the problem with that is these are people going to the mall, right? I mean, why should they know what a metastasis is? If they don't have cancer or a family member with cancer that has spread throughout their body, there's no reason they should know the word metastasis. In contrast, if you have a condition like diabetes and you're exposed to a lot of words that are technical and medical words, then it might be important to understand whether people understand those words and whether or not doctors are using them. So we simply audio taped our colleagues, and I will say in many ways this is probably a best case scenario. I mean, these are good doctors working in a public hospital where they recognize there are communication barriers. They're very sensitive to the needs of their patients. And most of us, I think, didn't believe that we use medical jargon, that we probably think we do a good job, and we probably do a good job. But nonetheless, we heard a lot of jargon. How many of you guys watch medical shows, nurse-doctor shows, House, ER, whatever? Half? What's that?
Anything with George Clooney.
Yeah, anything with George Clooney, yeah. Half, you guys are definitely lying. It's more like 95%. There we go. Now there's another hand. But I remember when I was in training, do you guys remember the show ER? So ER was the show. Was it also the show where you guys were in training? You were 2 years behind me. But I remember, so ER, why did people love ER so much? Part of it was the cool language, right? It was all these like thoracotomies and kiss me stat stuff going on. And I remember, I feel like I did the admission emergency room rotation like so many times. But every time I told a friend who was not a doctor that I'm working in the emergency room, they go, wow, is it really like ER? Are people like having sex on the gurneys? And I'm like, absolutely. It's amazing what we get to do in the emergency room. So what we were looking for were the times in which physicians used jargon, and we were specifically looking for unclarified jargon. So for example, if a doctor said, "Oh, it looks like your glucometer's broken. Maybe you need a new one," but didn't clarify what the word glucometer was, we labeled that as possibly jargon, and it was unclarified, and we counted it. If, on the other hand, they said, "I want you to go up to ophthalmology," those are the eye doctors, we didn't count that as we didn't ding the doctor because they're explaining it, they're clarifying it. I want you to note in the unclarified column that there are two kinds of words. There are the words that clearly can only be found in a medical dictionary, like glucometer or microvascular complication, right? And then there are words like your phrases, your weight is stable. We've heard that a lot. Your weight is stable. So what does stable mean to you? Just give me a definition. No change over time, right? That's one definition. That's to clinicians, that's what we think of when we say stable. No change over time. What else could it mean more lay language? Throw out some. If I asked my daughter, what does stable mean? Your weight's stable. She'd say, oh, it means it's good. It's good. Stable's good. So a lot of times people put a, what's the word I'm looking for? A qualifier on that, a value judgment. But it's also where the horse lives, right? Stable is where the horse lives. And so I think we included these words that had dual or triple meanings to understand if patients were using the language in the same way that we were using the language. Similarly, your blood sugars, that's a wide range of blood sugars that you have. The range is, you know, the degree of change on that graph of no change over time. Now we're changing over time. It's also, you know, where the horses who live in the stable run around in the field. So who knows? So we first thing we did is we looked at the visits and we explored, again, this is only the unclarified jargon. We didn't include the clarified jargon. We didn't include medication names because there's only one way to say insulin and benazepril and all these things. But we found some interesting things. First, the JPMs, which is jargon per minute, was 0.4, which means every 2.5 minutes we used an unclarified jargon term. Now, I don't know if that's frequent, infrequent. It needs to be done at Kaiser. It needs to be done at other health systems to see how we're doing relative to other places. But it's not nothing. We're using it. And when we're using it is when we're teaching, which is very interesting. Providing recommendations, providing health education, we're using microvascular complications. We're using the words that we were taught when we learned about diabetes. Let me give you a flavor for how this plays out in practice. This is a quote from an incredible physician who's now a geriatrician, really lovely physician, very patient-centered, who was actually having a very beautiful moment with her patient who had diabetes and hypertension, and she was trying to give her feedback that everything was going great. Your blood pressure's in good control, your blood sugar's in good control, and you're never going to need to be on dialysis because do you know what the number one cause for people in this country being on dialysis is? Diabetes. And smile and happy and wonderful. So we called this patient back as we did all of the other 60 patients and gave the whole context and phrase and everything and asked, what's the doctor saying here? What does dialysis mean? What was she trying to convey? And we scored the answers as a 1 if there was no understanding or a 4 if there was complete understanding. And I just want to give you a flavor of the variation of understanding of the word dialysis, which when you think of it, unless you've just seen the ER show where someone goes into dialysis for kidney failure or you have a family member who's on dialysis, theoretically, you have no reason to actually know what the word dialysis means. It's really a physician's framing of something to avoid. So this guy says, check something every day, dialysis. It sounds maybe like daily or diurnal or something. So it was a guess. Another guy says, is that about your toes? So really not getting it. Another one says, it means that your diabetes is going worse and that you have to exercise to make diabetes. Again, a counter to what the intention of the physician was. The next one says, you got to get on a machine to pump and redo blood to come up to par. So that guy got a 4, or that woman got a 4, and I like to joke that we took that person right into our kidney specialty fellowship and is now running our dialysis unit. So as you can see, tremendous variation. getting back to this assumption, the communication, the problem with communication is the assumption that it has occurred. Many people didn't understand what was being conveyed. Now, when we looked at whether the rates of comprehension here on the, it's like 20 to 30 to 35%, whether they differed depending on how we framed the question, or whether it was clarified jargon or unclarified jargon, or whether it came from your own visit or for your colleague's visit, it just never got over 35%. Weight is stable, no more than 35%, even if it was in your own visit, understood what that meant. At a 3 or a 4, we gave people credit if it was a 3 or a 4. So it suggests that we need to avoid jargon and do what my colleague Terry Davis in Louisiana likes to say is use living room language. That's what she says. Use the language that your patient would use in her living room. If she wouldn't use it in her living room, don't use it in your office. The second recommendation that came from this work was the idea of using the teach-back method. How many of you have heard of the teach-back method? 2 or 3? Okay. So this is a fundamental tool that teachers use. Every first grade teacher uses it, knows it, but very few doctors and nurses do. Although that is changing over time. I'll give you an example of how the first grade teacher might use it. Let's say this week's lesson plan is around learning the months of the year. So all week long they're doing fun activities in their circle time around January, February. When's your birthday? Mine's in March. When's Christmas? It's in December, right? And they, together, they're putting up the stickies and they're making the calendar. And then it's Friday morning and the teacher has everyone in the circle and she goes, "Great, class, you know, it's been a wonderful week when we've learned about the months of the year. Who would like to shout out some months of the year?" That's the teach back. You know, Jane goes, "February? Great." Melissa says, "My birthday's in June. Fantastic." You know, Jamie says, "Thursday?" She's like, "Okay, that's a day of the week, not a month of the year." And, you know, before at the end, she finds out that 5 months were remembered by 2 kids, and the rest of the class has not integrated her lesson plan. This is just the stuff of teaching. This is what good teachers do. Not just at the end of the week, but over the course of a day, and they continue to tailor and adapt their teaching to try to teach to a goal. And so we asked the question, do doctors use this teach-back method when conveying new concepts to their patients? This is not saying, so do you understand? Are we clear? It's saying, okay, Ms. Jones, we've talked about a lot of things. We talked about the fact that you have a new illness that you didn't know you had, and we've made a change to your treatment plan. When you go home and your husband says, "Honey, what did the doctor say?" Like, what are you gonna say? Because I want to make sure I explained it right. That's a teach back. And visually, it looks like a circle where you explain a new concept. You explicitly ask the patient to state it back, with putting the onus of failure on you, the teacher. And then hopefully at the end you are actually completing the cycle, so that at the end the person goes, "Yes, I heard you say I have diabetes and I have to start metformin once in the morning, once at night." Or, "I heard you say that I have breast cancer and that I need to see the cancer doctor," or whatever. I just want to share with you this fun cartoon, which may be hard for you in the back to see, so I'll walk you through it. This is the fact that teaching is one thing, right? So this is a guy who's in his living room reading the newspaper, and his puppy lifts up the leg and pees on the couch. How many of you have ever had this happen? We have a puppy now, and this is my life right here. So the guy's angry, and he takes him out of the house to show him a lesson. Like, this is the tree. Your job is to pee on this tree. Watch what I do. You pee on the tree, and let's go home and get it right. Okay, that's the teaching. Learning is quite another thing. Because what happens in the bottom right quadrant there is the dog stands up and pees on the couch. So this is the classic problem. And I can't tell you the number of times that I have made this error in assuming that I have, you know, where there's a 50-50 chance that I actually have not communicated it. This is what can happen. So it turns out that in only 12% of the new concepts that we convey do we do any form of teach back. When we do it, patients get it wrong, right? Heard the wrong thing, or pee on the couch instead of outside in the park half the time. Interestingly, those visits in which the physician used the teach-back loop were about the same length as those visits that didn't. But those visits, those patients in whom whose doctors used the teach-back method were nine times greater odds of having better blood sugar control. Now, that's not a randomized controlled trial. It's just an observation, but it's promising. Let me wrap up my talk by saying that we know that jargon is a problem, and we can reduce that. We know that we don't use the teach-back, and we should use it more, and it doesn't take more time, and it's high yield. And then we now understand that using well-tested visual aids can really help in engaging people to learn about their illness. We developed a diabetes education resource that was informed by our patients, specifically diabetes patients with low literacy, and they said like they hated those diabetes brochures and they wanted to see real food, like food that actually was appetizing and that showed me what we should do. And what we were trying to convey here is issues of portion size and issues of the distribution of meat, of protein, carbohydrate, and fruits and vegetables in a plate, essentially the plate model. And we were able to show that this way of demonstrating facts was much more likely to lead to better learning outcomes. A colleague of mine did a slightly more complicated version of this, where he took patients who were newly diagnosed with diabetes and had bad blood sugar, high blood sugars, and presented them with four options to get educated about their diabetes, specifically around nutrition. One was to do carb counting. Have any of you ever done carb counting? It requires some math, and you do all these carb equivalents and whatever. One slice of bread is like one little bowl of rice, and you're only allowed certain quantities each day. Compared to a simple plate model, which is this picture here, compared to a one-on-one diabetes educator experience, compared to nothing. And what he looked at was how much did the blood sugar fall in each of these four interventions. The bigger the bar, the bigger the fall. What he found was the simple plate method, the simple picture, was associated with a very large fall in blood sugar, and it worked for both the high numeracy and the low numeracy patients, whereas the carb counting worked really well if you had high numeracy skills, but didn't really work at all if you had low numeracy skills. The control group, not surprisingly, that didn't get anything didn't do that well. And those who went to the certified diabetes educator did well if they had high literacy, but if they had low, I'm sorry, numeracy, but if they had low numeracy, they didn't get as much from the one-on-one. So just another way to say that visual aids can be very powerful and important. I'm going to just close by summarizing. How many of you have seen this movie, Bill Murray, Lost in Translation? Great movie. That, you know, those of you who've been a patient, I've been a patient, I know this feeling, but this is more the norm than the exception. We need to acknowledge that and that we contribute to this problem. It's a problem for everyone, but it's particularly a problem for those with lower literacy and health literacy skills. These problems of limited literacy skills are concentrated in the populations that have other social vulnerabilities, whether it's low income, low educational attainment, racial and ethnic minorities, etc., and that we have a role, an important role, in the visit itself to address this problem by reducing our jargon, by using visual aids, by using the teach-back method, and really encouraging our patients to ask questions in a stigma-free, shame-free environment.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.